On April 5th, 2015, 26-year-old teacher Stephanie Scott planned to spend the day tying up loose ends in her classroom in preparation for her upcoming wedding. In just under a week, she and her long-term boyfriend, 27-year-old Aaron Leeson Woolley, would become husband and wife. Like most brides-to-be, the wedding prep had practically taken over all of her free time, but she had loved every single second of it. With the big day practically here, though, she decided she wanted to make things as easy as possible for the substitute teacher who would be taking over her classroom while she was away on honeymoon. It was Easter Sunday, her fiancé was away for the weekend, so it was the perfect opportunity to spend the day at the high school in Leeton, New South Wales, Australia, creating lesson plans for her drama students. Obviously, the school was locked up, but her colleague lived nearby and had offered to lend her keys to Stephanie. So she parked her car, and because her friend lived so close, they walked together to the school gate where her colleague unlocked it and handed the keys to Stephanie. Before settling down to work, she had texted Aaron at around 11 a.m. to let him know where she was in case he happened to arrive home earlier than expected. What she couldn't have ever realised was this text would help investigators track her whereabouts after her good deed took a devastating turn. Hey, Coffee and Crimers, I'm your host, Belle Fagan. Aaron had a great weekend catching up with his old buddies, but was ready to get back home to Stephanie. They had spoken the night before about them both heading out to dinner at their favourite local restaurant when he got back. So before heading for home, he booked a table just in case it was busy. Starting his drive, he calls Stephanie just to kind of let her know what time to be ready for and that he's actually on his way home. But each time he tries, she doesn't pick up. Telling himself that she'd probably gotten distracted by work or wedding planning, he tries not to worry. But when he gets home, neither Stephanie nor her car are there. He decides to try her phone one more time, but again, there's no answer. There is absolutely no way that she wouldn't have left a note or a text, but again, he tells himself that maybe she was just so busy at school she'd lost track of time, or maybe she'd even gone to a friend's house forgetting that they were going out to eat. What he does know, though, is he just can't sit and wait without knowing. So he gets back into his car and drives around the town, knowing that he will feel so dumb when he finds her. But then there's also that part of his brain that he's trying to ignore, telling him that something is wrong, because this wasn't like Stephanie at all. Her car isn't at the school, and driving around town turns up nothing. He's now seriously worried and panicking, but he's got no choice but to go back home. He cancels their dinner reservation and starts calling every single one of Stephanie's friends. As the list of names begins running out, he starts feeling sicker and sicker as fear sets in. Aaron spends the entire night tossing and turning, thinking that every single noise is her walking in, as well as willing his phone to ring. But it never did. As dawn arrived, Aaron knew that he really had no choice but to contact her family. One of five children, Stephanie was super close to her parents and her two sisters and two brothers, so he really didn't want to make this call. The sound of panic in their voices was instant. Just like Aaron, they knew that their Stephanie would never intentionally worry anyone, let alone the love of her life. They all agreed that there was no choice but to contact police. Every fibre of their being was telling them that Stephanie was in danger. While Aaron called police, her family repeatedly kept calling her mobile, just as Aaron had done the night before. And initially it rings and rings and rings, but before long an automated voice tells them that her mailbox is full. Now, none of us want to ever believe that something bad has happened to a loved one, and I think we'd all gaslight ourselves into believing that they're just going to burst through the door any minute full of apologies for worrying us. And this is exactly what Stephanie's parents tell themselves. But as the minutes ticked by with the door not opening, reality began to sink in. They were no longer hopeful. They were now just desperate. The town of Leeton was a town where literally one person could say something on one side of the town and within minutes, the entire town knew. So by the time Stephanie's brother posted on Facebook about her being missing, the news was already spreading fast. His post, though, was shared over 1,500 times. A description of her missing car was also put out, asking everyone to keep an eye out. Her best friend gave the local paper a picture of Stephanie, and before long, she was on the front page. A typical looking girl next door. And I think that kind of made this case more personal for everybody because she really looked like the kind of girl that could be anyone's daughter, sister, wife, girlfriend, whatever. And plus, no one wanted to believe that something bad could happen in a sleepy town like Leeton. Surely it was going to just be a case of cold feet, which is so typical for a lot of people about to walk down the aisle. Now, Stephanie's sister lived in Perth, so the other side of the country. And again, believing bad things didn't happen in Leeton, she posted on Facebook, quote, "Righto, Stephanie, I'm about to board my flight. I'm expecting good news when I switch my phone on in Sydney. I love you."
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One theory was that Stephanie might have rolled her car into one of the area's irrigation channels or creeks. She could have been tired, it could have been dark, whatever. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. Then, of course, there's the theory that Aaron might be involved. And we say it time and time again on this podcast that the spouse or the partner is the first to be looked at. Not only does it just make sense, but it's human nature to have suspicions about the ones closest to a missing person. Like, we don't want to believe that things are just random. But Aaron, looking ill with exhaustion, answered every single difficult question reporters threw at him and didn't stop posting or doing interviews. He never got mad at people asking the same questions over and over. The only thing he cared about was finding Stephanie, so he had nothing to hide, and if answering these questions helped in any way bring him closer to finding her, then he was going to do it. Divers searched irrigation channels, police officers on trail bikes searched the parkland, and volunteers carried out line searches along the side of local roads. But no clues were turning up. The family also asked everyone in the area to check their home surveillance cameras, just in case something had been caught without them realising. Finally, there was a breakthrough in the case. Stephanie's red Mazda was discovered in a field on a property at Wamoon, a few miles outside of Leeton. Aerial photos of Stephanie's car flashed across everyone's TV screens, and it was a super weird sight. The car was literally parked in the middle of the field amongst the grass, like so out of place. All this did, though, was throw up more questions than answers. Like, I mean, it's great that they found the car, but there's still no sign of Stephanie. And the car is in perfect condition, so this was definitely no car accident. So did she drive it there, or was it somebody else? And if it was somebody else, how did they get back to where they'd come from, as the car was literally in the middle of nowhere? So do you see what I mean? There is way more questions and not a single answer. Leeton High School reopened 2 days after Stephanie's disappearance, and the school janitor was just going about his usual cleaning jobs when a teacher noticed suspicious scratches on his face. So she asks him if he'd seen Stephanie at the school before she vanished. And he says, no, absolutely not, haven't seen her at all. So the teacher says, well, I guess then maybe she really did get cold feet, because this is all just like so weird. Vincent giggles and just walks away. What he didn't realise while giggling to himself was that police had been liaising with school officials and were told that although not contracted to work weekends, their school janitor, Vincent, sometimes would come in to check on things. Perfect. They finally figure they might have someone who could actually shed some light on Stephanie's movements that day. So the cops make arrangements to bring him in for an interview. 24-year-old Vincent also had an identical twin. So investigators decide to just bring them both in, but after speaking to them, they send Marcus, the twin, home, realising that he had absolutely no connection to the school whatsoever. So they start by asking Vincent if he had any interaction with Stephanie that day. He calmly explains to them that as much as he would like to help, he hadn't seen her at all on that Sunday, saying that he'd actually spent hardly any time at the school over that whole weekend because he'd been out practicing his hobby of photography, apart from a tiny period of time where he took a break to go grocery shopping. He was so confident that he even told them the name of the supermarket that he had gone to. Oh, Vincent, give someone long enough shoelaces and they'll trip. And trip is exactly what he did. Like, I don't know about where you guys are, but here in the UK, there ain't no supermarkets open on Easter Sunday. And the same is true in Australia. So police do their due diligence and still check with the store, just in case. And no shocker, they were, in fact, closed all day. And just like that, Vincent is suspect number one. So they ask to see the pictures that he'd taken on that day in question, and he hands over his phone with zero hesitation. And this is where I realised that he truly thought he was invincible. He'd already ballsed up with saying that he'd gone shopping, and now he just hands his phone over? Because as they scrolled through the photos, two gruesome images of what looked like a smouldering human corpse jumped out at them. Vincent just shrugs and says that the photos are screenshots taken from a website about a horror movie. Yeah, I don't think so. It's at this moment police know that they have been sitting across the table this whole time from a cold-blooded killer. So detectives place him under immediate arrest and a search warrant is given for the home that he shares with his mum and twin brother. Hidden in his bedroom, they find a red bra that would later be identified as Stephanie's, as well as her school ID and passkey. On his computer, they discovered his browser history full of websites on the dark web that showed women being sexually assaulted. Despite the evidence mounting up against him, Vincent maintains his innocence, at least to begin with. Police pull his phone records for the Sunday, and through the information from which phone towers he picked signal up from, they find themselves in a remote area, which they feared would be the ideal place to discard a body. On Friday, April the 10th, Stephanie's laptop was pulled from an irrigation canal just on the outskirts of town, and then at 5 p.m, searchers discovered her charred remains in a remote area of Kokopara National Park. The day after Stephanie's body was found, Vincent knew that the jig was up and he folded, giving a full confession, and the details of Stephanie's last hours were the stuff of nightmares. He told police that the minute he saw Stephanie sitting alone in her classroom, he knew that he was going to take her life. Because he had no way of knowing how long she would be there, he decided to act fast. He raced home and gathered items that he had pre-purchased for a day in the future that he hoped would arrive. Within the hour, he was back at the school with what he sickeningly referred to as his rape kit. As he entered the building, Stephanie was heading towards the exit, packed up and ready to leave. As she passed him, she smiled and wished him a happy Easter. The second she went past him and her back was turned, he grabbed her from behind and dragged her, kicking and screaming, into a storage room. Once inside, he punched her in the face several times, knocking her to the floor. He then handcuffed her hands and secured the door and carried out one of the most brutal rapes, one that he had thought about for as long as he could remember. When he finished, he hit Stephanie across the face and head another 30 or 40 times before plunging a knife into her throat. Making sure that she was dead, he then simply went home and had a cheese sandwich and coffee with his family. I won't lie, guys, this case really, really got to me. Coming back to the school later that afternoon, Vincent had placed Stephanie's body in her car and thoroughly cleaned the blood that had covered nearly every inch of the storage room. Satisfied that he'd committed basically the perfect murder, he drove home and parked her car at the back of his property so that it couldn't be seen from the road. He just needed to figure out what to do next. After giving it some thought, he decided that he'd figure it out after a good night's sleep. Early the next morning, he had driven 43 miles to the Kokopara National Park, where he took Stephanie's body from the car and laid it out onto the ground. He covered her with kindling, removed her engagement and graduation rings, took her driver's license, and set her on fire. He then pulled out his phone and snapped pictures to commemorate his kill, which was the pictures the police had seen. Waiting until the fire had died down, he got back into the car and drove back towards town. 4 miles out from his destination, he pulled over and left Stephanie's Mazda in the middle of that field. Just trying to find out some sort of motive as to why he'd killed her, he simply replied to police that he had no choice. He'd been fighting the urge to kill someone since he was 7 years old, and he was actually pretty smug at the fact that he had held out as long as he did. He said he'd been so overwhelmed with the thought of murder when he caught sight of Stephanie that he couldn't have stopped himself even if he'd wanted to. He hadn't set out on planning to harm anyone that day, but finding her alone and vulnerable had just been too perfect an opportunity to pass up. Like, how those officers didn't strangle him right there and then, I don't know. And he didn't stop there. He carried on by saying that the vicious attack on Stephanie had actually allowed him to release pent-up anger that had been building inside him for years. Everything he had just said proved to detectives that if he hadn't have been caught, he would 100% have killed again. Like, he had unleashed the beast. There would have been no going back. A court-appointed psychologist evaluated Vincent and determined that he had a deep hatred for the entire human race that had affected every aspect of his life. He explained that he had taken the janitor's job because he could work at his own pace with no supervision, and the isolation of that job was perfect for his antisocial personality. Her report also noted that Vincent couldn't stand to be touched and would physically recoil from any well-meaning attempt at physical contact. His view was that those around him were detestable and that the world would be a better place without them. No, Vincent, it would just be better off without you. He told the psychologist that his violent attack on Stephanie had meant so little to him that he had completely forgotten about the whole thing by the time investigators had come knocking on his door. I can't believe that's true, surely not. And as if just saying that part wasn't bad enough, he felt the need to really drive home the point that Stephanie's life had meant nothing to him. When they asked why he'd laughed when his colleague had said about maybe she'd had cold feet or something about the wedding, he said that he'd laughed to himself because he knew that she wouldn't be walking anywhere, let alone down the aisle. Oh, my blood is running cold. The more he talked, the more it became obvious that the person Vincent hated the most was himself. He shared that he would self-harm in order to let out some of the pressure that he would feel building inside of him. On the day that he killed Stephanie, he had decided that instead of cutting himself, he would channel all of his bottled up rage onto her. Now, his background should have rung alarm bells. He'd actually been sent to a behaviour school in 2001 and 2002 in the Netherlands because of his unruly behaviour. He had limited social skills, so no real friendships, and he had oppositional defiant disorder. He was admitted to an adolescent psychiatric centre for behavioural problems and violent incidents, with the facility finally diagnosing him with autism as well as the ODD that I just said, the oppositional defiant disorder. After he was released, he was referred for behaviour management, but he wasn't prescribed any medication. He just continued into his early adulthood just as temperamental, exploding at the drop of a hat. He also had a history of stalking and harassing women, mainly because he didn't know how to emotionally engage in a healthy mutual relationship. So instead, he would just watch them from a distance and try and figure out how to get them to be his. He also confessed to stalking a 12-year-old girl who lived locally for several months before he got bored. His plan had been to kidnap her when he felt the time was right, but for some reason, he was aware that the repercussions, if it went wrong, would be huge. So he moved on. While Vincent sat in jail waiting on his trial, police began looking into his twin brother, Marcus. When they interviewed him at the start of their investigation, he'd said that he had no idea what had happened to the missing teacher. But after hearing everything that Vincent had confessed to police, they just couldn't believe that Marcus truly had zero clue. So on May 30th, they bring Marcus back in for questioning. Detectives go hard at him, saying that he must know something, even if it was something as small as where Stephanie's rings had gone, which at the time hadn't been found. He kept repeating over and over that he knew nothing. But when they took a look at his computer, they actually found searches for places to sell jewellery near Adelaide, dated 4 days after Stephanie's remains were found. Marcus was arrested and charged with being an accessory to murder after the fact when they found a business card in his belongings that was for a jewellery store in Adelaide, just like he had searched. Records from the store showed that someone had pawned Stephanie's rings on May 9th for $705. 9 months later, on March 31st, 2016, Marcus pleaded guilty to selling the rings and burning her driver's license at his brother's request. He'd also taken a picture of it, saving it to his phone as a trophy. Like, what is it with these two sickos taking photos as keepsakes? Unlike Vincent, though, Marcus did show remorse, apologising over and over, saying that it was no excuse, but he'd done those things out of loyalty to his twin. He was sentenced to 15 months behind bars, but was released in September of 2016 after serving less than half of that sentence. He moved in with his dad miles and miles away from his own hometown, and allegedly he is very rarely seen, keeping himself to himself, only venturing out when absolutely necessary. His loyalty to his brother is now a thing of the past. He literally cut off all ties with him immediately. But back to Vincent. In July of 2016, Vincent pleaded guilty to murder, aggravated sexual assault, and infliction of bodily harm before the New South Wales Supreme Court. And on November 14th of that year, he was sentenced to life for the murder charge, plus 15 years for aggravated rape. The judge had made a point of stating for the record that his lack of remorse had weighed heavily on the sentencing decision. Now, parole is technically a possibility down the line, but it is more than likely that he'll die in prison. And this part just made me sick. Because of how callous his crime was, he's actually been in danger many times since being locked up, meaning that prison guards have to essentially keep him safe to protect him from the other inmates. So he's allowed to shower alone, he's allowed to eat his meals in an area that's solely his. Frankly, I say just let the other inmates have at him. On Saturday, April the 11th, 2015, on what would have been their wedding day, Stephanie's family held a celebration of her life in their local park. Everyone wore yellow, her favourite colour, and the day was filled with laughter and joy in honour of how she had spread happiness everywhere she went. I wish it ended there, though. As if Stephanie's family hadn't been through enough, 3 weeks after Vincent's sentencing, her dad, Robert, was killed in a freak accident at the family's home. He was hit by a falling tree as he was clearing a wooded area. A 59-year-old retired teacher, he died on impact. Now, I have to do this for like my own mental health and well-being. I try and look for the positives, So two saving graces. Not only did he live to see justice for Stephanie, but he also died instantly. I am just so broken for this family. Although justice had been served when it came to Vincent, Stephanie's family truly felt that her murder could have been prevented. So they actually filed a civil lawsuit against the New South Wales Education Department, as well as the third-party agency who had contracted out Vincent's position. This was never about financial gain for them. Instead, they wanted change. They wanted to win the lawsuit so that stricter hiring methods would be put in place, meaning that people who pose a danger to others don't fall through the cracks. The case was settled in 2021, but the terms weren't made public. School representatives argued that they had carried out a criminal background check on Vincent and it had come up clean, but they did agree that they would follow stricter guidelines in the future. And okay, maybe he didn't have a criminal record, but surely if you've got a kind of medical record that shows that you do have a disorder that pretty much makes you dangerous, surely that needs to go in some database? I don't know, but I do agree that her murder could have been prevented. In 2022, Aaron announced that he had found love again and that he and his new partner, Snee, were engaged. Having been to hell and back, I really do believe that he deserves to go through the rest of his life with happiness. And I also hope that the rest of Stephanie's surviving family can also find peace too. To see today's case photos, click on the link in the case description to join the Cup of Coffee and Crime Facebook discussion group. Until next week, stay safe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.